Hey, folks, hope you had a good weekend. Real quick, my one-man show, Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak, is still playing at the Actors Temple Theater in New York City here. If you're in the area or you're coming to New York for the holidays or whatever it might be, come check out a show. It's an audience interactive show. Audience members come up, talk about their lives, or just, you know, can sit and watch and enjoy it. But it's been a really cool, really unique show, and people really seem to be enjoying it. So I hope you can come and check it out. Go to telecharge.com for tickets and use the code PMFAN. That's PMFAN. And you get half off tickets. And again, it's telecharge.com. And we're running to the end of the year. It's at the Actors Temple Theater here in New York City on West 47th Street. Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak. My favorite loyal sponsor, deepdiscount.com, is having some great, great buys right now during their Black Friday Cyber Week sale. Go to deepdiscount.com. You get there by going to my website, paulmercurio.com. Click on the Deep Discount logo, and it'll take you to their site. Really great stuff. TV shows, movies, books, apparel. I'm getting stuff every week. This week, books. I decided I should read, you know, words. So I got the Beastie Boys book, and that's exactly what it's called, the Beastie Boys book. Not to be confused with, like, the Rolling Stones book. This is a book, and they named it a book, and they told you in the title it's a book. Really cool sort of history of the Beastie Boys, how they started out sort of, you know, more punk, and then moved over to rap and working with Russell Simmons and Rick Rubin. Just a really, really cool look into a really creative group of guys. I highly recommend it. It's for sale. Also, my buddy Anthony Cumia's book is out, Permanently Suspended. It's a long-awaited life story, answers many of the questions fans have been waiting for. I know a lot of the answers because I was part of the ONA show for a long time and involved in some of their history. So, really interesting book, really great book. Anthony certainly has lived an interesting life, and he's still going strong. Check it out. Permanently Suspended, Anthony Cumia's book. Order your copy now for a great price. Just click on Deep Discount logo on my website, paulmercurio.com. Click on the Deep Discount logo there, and you'll take you right to their site, and you'll get some really great deals on stuff leading into the holidays here. And my guest this week, I think you're going to really, really enjoy who it is. It's John McGinley. He's a great, great actor in Scrubs. He made his name in Scrubs. He's in Stand Against Evil now, stars in that, and a really cool conversation. Very intense guy, really, really a great actor. Talks about his method and his process, which is stuff I always love to hear. So enjoy, John, and check out my one-man show, Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak, on Telecharge. Welcome back to the show. My guest this week, someone that I've been a big fan of for a long time. You know him from his role as Dr. Perry Cox on Scrubs, and he's currently in a really great show on IFC, Stand Against Evil. It is John C. McGinley. How are you, John?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Really, a lot of stuff I want to talk to you about, but jumping right into the series. My pal Dana Gould created it, and I know him from the stand-up world, a great guy. And how do you enjoy working with him, and how did you come to kind of connect with him on this project?
Dana came out here, they offered me the show, and I read all 8 episodes 3 years ago now. And Danny came out to the house, and what I thought was really important was that what Dana had written for his protagonist, for the titular character of Stan, was he wrote this really damaged, really injured, very flawed guy. And what I told Dana, because he's the one who put it on the page, not me, I said, you've written this guy who is so very damaged. I said, you got to promise me that we'll explore some of that, because what writers can write are damaged characters. And in other words, the Ken and Barbie construct will only get you for a couple of pages, but writers can really dig their hands into damaged, flawed characters. And I said, Danny, this guy is so flawed, a la Archie Bunker. And I said, I want to find out if he can reconcile these damages, or if he cares to, or if he has the tools to, or the wherewithal. I said, that's where this is going to get really interesting. And Dana said he would, and he was a man of his word. And when we go to these different Comic-Cons, whether it's San Diego or New York, or we did one down in Orange County yesterday, what resonates with the audience is this, that Stan is this really damaged guy. But he's trying his hardest. And just like Archie Bunker, in other words, if you're just an equal opportunity insulter, we're going to change the channel. But there's something, you got to bait the hook a little bit. There got to be something on there. And that's what Dana has done with this guy trying to. In the first 3 minutes of the pilot, he loses his wife of 28 years and his job of 27 years. Well, now what? And so, you know, in the narrative, he just wants to sit in his recliner and watch the History Channel, but he can't even do that because 172 witches are trying to kill him. So, call action and get out of my eye line. That's great stuff.
Well, you know, Dana says that. He goes, you know, every season, at the end of the season, I paint myself into a corner intentionally. And I remember seeing that, you know, as someone that also writes, and thinking, you know, that open, I'm like, wow, you really... You start with a lot of interesting, fertile stuff, but where do you go? You really paint yourself into a corner when you have your protagonist lose his wife and his job and within the first 3 minutes of an episode. I thought that was pretty gutsy in the writing.
I did too. But I wanted the follow-up to be, okay, now how does this guy reconcile this?
Right.
Or does he?
Right.
Or does he struggle with it? Or does he have the magic answer? Or does he find solitude in the offing of witches? And of course he doesn't.
Right.
He doesn't. He's still prepared to be a hero. He's just lost everything. I mean, his first instinct with the first witch he meets is to grab a lead pipe and bash the witch over the head. I mean, of course he doesn't have a secret ray gun or anything. He doesn't have secret powder.
Right.
He grabs a pipe and just crushes this witch's skull. But of course that's what he does.
Right.
What else are you supposed to do?
Right, right. Well, that's what I would do. I think that's why it's so relatable. You know what I mean? I think people like that's it. And I think in a world, you know, politically and otherwise, where people are trying to put one over on the viewers all the time, there's an honesty about this that feels, it's this odd mix of like, it's wacky kind of, I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's out there, it's witches and this and that. And then it's a guy that you can relate to in a way, or that is, you know, as Dana said, it was, what if my dad was Buffy the Vampire Slayer? What if my dad, who I've described as Archie Bunker without the elegance and sophistication, what if he was a monster fighter? This is his quote. The show fell out of my head very quickly from there. And that's, I know Dana, and I know that's how he talks and thinks. And it's like, do you think when you say bait the hook for people, meaning that there's a sense that there's a little bit of sympathy for this guy, this character, that this a guy that is trying to not just be a complete asshole his whole life? Well, what do you mean by that?
I don't think assholes ever try to be assholes. I think he lives in a really narrow frequency band. And that comfort zone, he's got it all squared away in this little hamlet in New Hampshire, and he's had it all kind of dialed in. He's only had it dialed in because he doesn't know squat. He doesn't know that his wife goes out every night and keeps him alive. He doesn't know anything. He's probably never drawn his weapon in the 27 years he's been a sheriff.
Right.
So it's just great that our hero, on top of all this, what Dana writes is that our hero will save the day. He'll do the right thing in the bottom of the ninth with the bases jacked, only so he doesn't have to hear about it. He wants the gold medal, not because he wants a pat on the back, just because he doesn't want to hear about it if he doesn't do it. And that's just the most ass-backwards hero in the history of the world. It's so subversive. It's great.
Yeah.
And so that's that. And that's our hero?
Right, exactly. Right. You mean it's not the bionic man who, the bionic woman?
It's not Steve Austin. Yeah. It's just this guy who... He wants to just watch the History Channel. It's the best thing. And Dana just, the way he's constructed this thing, you know, the guy who ran the Simpsons writer's room for almost 10 years, where you have to put emotional Kevlar on every day before you go to work. And the whole time he's in there, the one thing he wanted to do was this. Well, that's a hell of a pedigree.
Yeah.
And so that this flows, and he doesn't have a writer's, like on Scrubs, we had 14 writers. All of whom were the editors of the Lampoon, went to Harvard. They were these unbelievably bright young men and women. And Bill Lawrence would ride roughshod over all of them. And then seven would leapfrog every episode. And so, but with Dana, it's Dana and a tiny tiny cadre of two or three people, and they just crank this stuff out around about January, and then it shows up on your desk come March, and you can't even believe you get to say some of this stuff on primetime.
Yeah, I know. I know. And you're a producer on it. Do you guys, in that process, when you get those scripts, do you ever discuss, I mean, does it ever feel like, hey, I love this, Dana, but this one feels so out there. I'm not sure that this is, we have to be a little grounded in this or whatever. Like, do you ever have those conversations, or what is your process in that?
Absolutely. And where I am useful is in shaping the piece and shepherding the tone. Mm. And what I mean by tone, and Dana and I are both obsessed with the tone, so I'm not doing this alone. The tone lives in comedy horror, lives somewhere between The Exorcist, which is on one extreme, which is scary as heck, but you can't drop a joke. And the other extreme is Scooby-Doo, where it's funny, but the threats are largely declawed. Mm. And so we live somewhere in the middle there with An American Werewolf in London and Ash. And that tone is really hard to live in that middle there. And here's why. The monsters can completely step on your jokes, and the jokes can completely invalidate the monsters if you're not careful. And so if every joke is at the monster's expense, then all of a sudden there's no threat and whatever.
Yeah,
our fans are so fanatic about the witches that they damn sure better be a threat, and the jokes still have to be funny. And so that middle ground, unless you shepherd it really meticulously, and have a couple of people watching your back. In other words, you know, Dana wrote the greatest joke in the history of the world, but it completely takes the wind out of the threat. We got to look at the joke. Because the threat, are the people at these Comic-Cons and the people who watch the show, they like them some witches.
Oh, yeah.
And so if we all of a sudden make the witches just ass faces, it's a big fat whatever.
You know, it's funny. I said that to my wife one night. I go, this has got to be the hardest thing to write. And she said, why? I said, because you're really like walking on a razor thin line of like, making the comedy believable in the context of this horror show and making the horror believable within the context of a comedy show. I'm so fascinated to hear that. I think that's got to be so.
The first one who has picked that out, and it's all Dana's. Dana and I are obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Everything, that's the springboard that launches the whole show. Unless that tone, and I beat this into the goddamn ground, unless that tone is shepherded, is protected, we're dead.
Yeah, it takes you out of it. It takes you. Yeah.
These characters are great, but the milieu, the landscape that they have to roam around in, is the tone, and that's where we work unbelievably well together.
It's really well done. And by the way, it doesn't surprise me that a comedian can write this character, because we're pretty damaged people, and I can say that, you know. And a lot of times comedians, I mean, it's funny to also hear sometimes, you know, acting is a very different discipline than stand-up comedy, but it doesn't surprise me that there a fair number of stand-ups can be good actors, dramatic actors, because a lot of the comedy comes from sort of a darker place at times for us, you know.
I totally agree. As long as there's some discipline introduced,
yes,
stand-ups are great on sets. If they show up, and I've been on both sets, if they show up and everything is just let's pull a rabbit out of our hat, we're dead. Because sets don't work that way, and neither largely do great comedians. You guys work that material to a fine edge. You know, until you're blue in the face, but
right.
Some people show up on the set, and all they do is add the preface, I mean, you know, literally, people, the stand-up comics now say literally and actually.
Right.
So the line can be, hey, Paul, what time is it? What time is it? You know, I mean, well, literally, actually, it was, no, just say the line.
Yeah.
We'll punch you guys in the esophagus sometimes.
Yeah, no, I understand. Well,
what's on the page?
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, you know, having trained as an actor myself, and it's sort of, it's a very different discipline, because You know, if you're a good stand-up, you really have to bifurcate your mind when you're doing your show, and you're doing your material, but you're also listening to the room and sort of assessing what's happening and is this working? Yeah. And you can't do that as an actor. I have to be in the moment with you as my partner in that scene and not be stepping out of myself and going, how did I just say that line? Should I say it different? The next line different?
A lot of stand-ups can't. They can't shut off that bifurcation switch.
Yeah.
And it's brutal. You see them and you can see that half the brain is watching themselves and the other is with you. And you're like, dude, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, your character on Scrubs too, though, was one of the more interesting characters on TV for me because he was sort of a damaged guy in a way to me and I thought that was fascinating.
Billy Barnes never made him redundant. Look, unless these guys are flawed, and if you're lucky enough to do a show for 9 stinking years, become an exercise in redundancy.
And yeah.
What a horrible thing for to get pages where you're just repeating behavior that you did for the first 7 years. And because Dr. Cox was just so effed up, Billy could continue to write him really fresh and insane.
Yeah.
And it was great. So he never, of all the characters on that show, he never kind of revisited the same landscape again and again.
And did you sort of have a similar working relationship with him that you do with Dana, where you were sort of contributing to the ideas of the direction and the arc of the character?
Somewhat, but I was just an actor on that show and in a huge ensemble. And so Billy would take as much input as you wanted to give, but it's different when you're a producer on something as opposed to, I've produced 5 movies, and it's different when you're a producer or you're the guy who we want you to hit your mark and say your lines and be fabulous and then go away. And that's fine. That's fine. But I had done a TV show right before this and it broke my heart when it was canceled. I didn't want to do them anymore. So this was a turn, and the turn had to be, I wanted a bigger bite of the apple. I didn't want more money. I wanted more creative autonomy.
Yeah.
In this case, Dana.
Well, you know, Dana said, this is a quote of his and your co-star, Janet Varney. He said, John and Janet are real serious actors who built these characters before they even stepped in front of the camera. They asked a lot of questions of me about the past lives, and that forced me to be a better writer. It forced me to really sink the story's support beams deep into the bedrock. And for people out there who don't know, who just think, oh, acting is you get handed a script, you memorize the lines, you get makeup, you say the lines, and then you go have lunch. Explain that your process, so you get this character and then you start to have to build a backstory, a back life, a life for this person so that you can really live this person on camera honestly, right?
Well, the first thing I do is I break a script down, I take it off the page and I put it in my own hand, I put it in a composition book so that it kind of takes, even though it's just a physical gesture, I do take the words away from the writer and give them to myself.
You write them, you actually handwrite them down in a book?
In a composition book, yes.
Wow.
I've done 100 films. I get all the books are down in the rehearsal space. I keep a rehearsal space in Los Angeles. And then in that composition book, in the margins, I put the verbs of what you're doing. And every time there's a piece of punctuation, there has to be a new verb. And the verb has to aggressively serve the text and get you through the narrative. And then by the time I've done that, I pretty much know the script backwards. And then my teacher comes, and then we start to play because I've already broken the script down. And now we start to play, and then I can see the arc of what's going on because I've written it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mind-numbing work, mm-hmm. but I have to do it. And it's the best way to get the words into your head is to own them.
Mm-hmm.
For the easiest way to own them is to put them in your own hand.
Yeah.
For me, not for anyone else. For me. And that this process has served me around the planet because all I really care about is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
When young actors come out here and work with me, I want to know what you're doing. And you can't use the word try because I don't give two shits what you're trying to do. I want to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be as easy as you're tying your shoelace. Mm-hmm. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it serves the text. And if it serves the text and we're moving through with these aggressive verbs, then we will have something.
Mm-hmm. So you, so in other words, there'll be a sentence and there'll be a period, and you replace that period with a verb, like.
No, that just means if it's just one sentence without a comma, then only one verb needs to be employed.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, if it's like
if the line is, what time is it? Are you fishing? Are you flirting? Are you working backwards from when the bomb's going to go off?
Oh, I see. Yeah. Why are you asking what time it is? Right. Gotcha.
No, not why. What are you doing?
Yeah. Okay.
I don't care why.
Yeah.
But what are you doing?
Yeah. Because then that'll inform everything else. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Interesting.
If you're stalling, that's different than flirting. Those are two different verbs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The text should give us some hints. I mean, if you're at a bar and you're asking somebody what time it is, you're checking if you're late for your appointment.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Or you're waiting for your date to come. Yeah.
Do something.
Right. Right. Yeah. And then that informs the behavior and all of that. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a really interesting process. Yeah. My acting coach always tells me, I worked with this guy, Bob Krakauer, here in New York. And he always says, you know, what's the story? What story are you telling? You're telling a story in pictures. And, he's given us a very effective, somewhat simple, but yet effective process to, you know, get you out of, you know, sort of the tried and true sort of, I don't know, the acting, the cute acting words that people like to use to get acting done. And he really makes you sink your teeth into the text and the story you're telling. And of course it's great.
I love that.
Yeah. And you go back to Circle in the Square and, you know, you're a Broadway, off Broadway actor. So I'm sure that base of education for you is the foundation for everything that you're doing now and allows you to work so effectively and creatively with these characters, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, the mandate when we were at NYU Grad, which is a theater program at Conservatory, and Olympia Dukakis was our master teacher, and the mantra was 8 a week. And what that means is when you're doing an off-Broadway or Broadway schedule, you do 8 shows a week, you do 6 nights and 2 matinees. So, the whole program was built around supporting you being able to do 8 shows a week. Mm. So in other words, how are you going to protect your voice? How are you going to not get hurt in that fight with Paul at the end of the first act where you guys have to dive over the couch in that wrestling match? When you can't get hurt, it's not possible because you have to do it tonight.
Right.
And then you have to do it tomorrow night. You can't get a wrist.
Mm.
You can't hurt your wrist. You can't.
Mm.
And so we're responsible for that. And being clean with the text, you can't, I can't flub lines. That's going to throw you off.
Right.
That's impossible.
Mm.
And so everything was 8 a week. And that afforded us this toolkit of ways to break down a script, which I just told you.
Mm.
And that all was born out of what Olympia had us doing.
Yeah, it's great. Well, I know the feeling about the live performance. I'm doing a one-man show right now at the Actors Temple Theater here in the city, and it's exhausting, you know, and also producing it. So every day there's like an issue or something to deal with on top of the performance. So
I
mean, it's the most rewarding thing I've done, and it's not stand up. It's an audience interactive sort of immersive show that's completely improvised with the audience, but it's still, it's like you got to be in shape for it mentally, physically. It's a grind. I would love to talk to you more. There's so, working with Oliver Stone, your son, and Down syndrome, but I know you're busy. Maybe we'll pick up for another conversation down the road. But I think this is utterly fascinating, and the way you work is really great. Continued success from season 3 of Stand Against Evil on IFC. It's John C. McGinley. Really, really great to talk to you, and please let's do this again. Thanks for being on.
100%.
All right, there you go. John McGinley. I could talk to that guy for a while, man. There's a lot going on with him. Really, really intense actor. Check out my one-man show, Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak, on Telecharge. Use the code PMFAN, and you get 50% off. And And appreciate you guys checking out the podcast. And always, as always, tell your friends about it and leave some nice comments on iTunes. Thanks, folks.